Colonel Collins, row 14. Very soon, as you mentioned, after the peace, or V-Day, you were moved up to Austria. Do you remember much about the journey? It was
I don't remember a detailed place that I was going to. I could recall now that we went, because when, you know, we've been there since. I haven't got a map in front of me now, but what I do remember was, of course, the hordes of disarmed soldiers with their horse transport. They all had horse transport, you know, that was extraordinary thing to us. With their horse transport, and then crowds of civilian refugees on the roads. And I've got the old photograph, actually, which I took at the time. Just show you, and obviously the listeners to this can't hear that. That was the sort of thing we were passing on the road, refugees, or passing or overtaking on the road. And so we went up into the Klagenfurt area in Carinthia, southern Austria, and we're deployed there. I don't remember much about the actual journey itself beyond that, seeing those. And I don't remember how many days we did, although I do remember we, you know, staging and taking over billets at odd places on the way.
When you got into Austria, what sort of reception did you get from the Austrians? Because they've been the enemy.
What a relief, I think, particularly in those areas where the Russians had been. They were not very popular.
It's fairly obvious why, but could you just tell, was there any evidence of how the Russians had behaved?
No, I didn't see any evidence. I can't think how the Russians came to be there. But this seemed to be the word. They were sort of relieved to see us. But there was generally, my main impression is one of, how can I describe it, but not indifference, but a sort of stony, stoical silence, really. There was no euphoric reception of us, I don't think, like there were when people went back into France and that sort of thing. Now, obviously, because they were defeated countries.
It says that the main work was rounding up enemy POWs, German POWs, and dealing with refugees. How did you go about those two tasks?
Well, with difficulty, as they say these days. I can't quote particular incidents. I've got a mental image, for example, of one of a German officer who was going around in one of those little Volkswagen, and I had got hold of him and disarmed him once and ordered him to go to a certain place. Didn't take away his vehicle from him. It was a mistake, because a couple of hours later, I saw him drive by, the same chap driving by again in the same vehicle. But that sort of thing, I don't remember exactly. I don't remember, you know, corralling people or anything like that. Or maybe we must have done, I suppose.
But you don't remember. Anything else about Klagenfurt before you went to Bleiburg? That was towards, because we in that was where you met the Croatians and the Yugoslav forces of Bleiburg, yeah.
And we were talking about before that, weren't we? I mean, the Croatians and phase, I remember, what I remember about that was that we were sent down to the Austrian border, the border with Yugoslavia, to secure the crossing points and prevent the unfortunate Croats who were being pursued by the Serbs, and were trying, because they were, as you know, sort of Catholics and orientated towards Austria. The Serbs were not, and the ethnic rivalry has been brought out all too starkly in the recent past. And even then, they held together during the war. The moment the Germans had gone in, the Serbs were at the Croats, I suppose, and vice versa. And it was a harsh thing to have to do. We had to prevent these Croat refugees from coming into Austria, you know, and felt dreadful. The women and children with all their belongings trying to escape into Austria, and we had to prevent them.
Did you have to threaten force, or?
Well, quite heavy handed, I can't say that. I mean, women and children can't really walk past soldiers with big bayonets very easily. You don't have to threaten anything harsh than that. They say no, you can't get past. But, you know, it was rather sad. I dare say they found other ways around, some of them. But, so we did that for a period. But I remember being, we
a large party of Croats were also repatriated to Yugoslavia, or repatriated, perhaps not the right word, sent back to Yugoslavia. Do you remember that at all?
I don't remember that. But they had come into Austria. No, I don't remember that. I don't remember it now.
Anything else about the Croatians? Or
no, nothing about the Croatians, but I remember, of course, rounding up the Germans being rounded up and disarmed and all their horses taken away from them. Well, of course, we had the problem of coping with all these horses. I mean, there were many horses as there were men.
Now, this, because everyone started riding, according to the Stringer's book.
It became the in thing. But you see, there were all these horses, all these saddlery. And anybody who knew a bit about horses, for example, Dennis Worrell, the CEO, he'd been a horseman. And my company commander, Harry Mindyak, he'd been a horseman. I hadn't, in fact, up to that point. But everyone had a go, you know. And there were some nasty accidents as a result. But, you know, be able to let on a bit of steam and canter about the place. I can't remember how the horses were looked after and groomed and that sort of thing. When we kept the Germans, they didn't do that. I don't know. I suppose it is. How they were fed.
Now, you moved through Bleibow to Bruchel.
Bruchel, there, that's right.
Now, what do you remember of that?
Well, I remember quite a lot about that. We were there for some time. And
you were dealing with the Cossacks there as well.
I think, yes. The Cossacks, you know, I'm a bit confused about this now. They're the White Russians, aren't they? Who are on the German side, that's right. And they're the ones about whom there's been this political stir recently. They had to be. The difficulty with them was, of course, that we knew that they were persona non grata as far as the Soviet Union was concerned. But that was where they were going to end up. And I think there was some agreement, wasn't there? A high level agreement. I think it was the Yalta Conference or something like that.
But you wouldn't know the background to that at your level.
I didn't know that background of my own knowledge at the time. All I knew was that we had that there was some concern about where these chaps were to go, and we had to get them on the vehicles, and they were sent off. But I really didn't know. I don't remember now whether I knew where they were to be sent.
Did they put up any opposition to being sent back that you remember?
I don't remember any.
Would you actually be there when they were being put on the trucks?
Yes, I do remember some of them being loaded on the trucks. But, I mean, there were a very large number of them, so I obviously wasn't everywhere. But I don't remember. I mean, I think they just went like sneak sheep to the slaughter, really. I think they were suspicious that they were being sold down the river. But I think they were being told some trumped-up stories. There were various rumors, you know, they were going to Canada and that sort of thing. And it was all very sad and very difficult. It was very, very high-level politics. But I was going to say one little thing. I've got another photograph here. I'll just show you, because at somewhere at that stage, when we had this waiting period, they had a band there, a regimental band. We got the German band to entertain our troops. You see that?
Brass band.
Yeah, a brass band. That's right. So, but what I remember about Brooklyn, we were dispersed there, and the mortar platoon were a little way down the road at a little village called Philippine. And we were in, I think, we were in the village itself.
Where were we billeted?
We were billeted in a farmhouse. We had a company headquarters in a farmhouse. But the particular little anecdote, I didn't think about that, which I remember very well. My friend, Lionel Dodd, was billeted in a house in this village of San Filipino, which was found to contain this rather dishy Austrian film star named Elfie Meyerhofer. She was a singer, and she lived there with her uncle. And anyway, she was very good. She would come up to our mess and sing, for us, and that sort of thing. And, you know, she was a top line professional singer. And being in certain films in Austria, I've never seen her on the film for myself. With Alison Philippin, we were there. Well, of course, we were doing again training and trying to get fit. Actually, I had a lucky escape there for a while. I was sent on we all had to go and do a PT course, you see, at some stage there. And this may have been slightly before, I'm not quite sure. And the very first morning, playing a handball game or something like that, I dislocated a finger. And I was sent back, and they couldn't reduce it then, so I was sent back to the casualty center, where, fortunately for me, our former MO, dear old Doc Jones, was doing a spell there at the casualty clearing center, and he decided that I needed a fortnight's rest and recuperation and convalescence at the sort of convalescent camp, which was the hotel on the shores of the Klagenfurt Lake. So I had a lovely fortnight there when it was about June 45. So that I particularly remember that.
One thing it mentions is that they were looking for Nazis, do you remember that going around trying to find, tracking down any? So what's the next thing you remember?
Beyond that, I don't have any really distinct memories of that particular village, if you like. Until then, we were in the move up into Steiermark, or Styria, as we call it in England. And the whole division was going to move up there. And our battalion was in a town called Vildon. It's in the valley of the River Mur, M-U-R. I'm just desperately trying to think of the... Graz was the name of the town, where division headquarters, I think division... certainly our gunner friends were there. They were all in Graz. We were at Vildon, which was perhaps some 20 or 30 miles away, something like that. And we used to exchange visits. Now, just about that time, I'm pretty sure it was Laurie Stringer. For some reason, I think Dennis Wilde was away, and I think he temporarily left the battalion. I think not for the first time, but he temporarily left the battalion. And the second in command at that stage was one Reggie Denny, a very nice man, had left us, on promotion. And Laurie Stringer, Major Stringer, was temporarily in command of the battalion. And I'm sure it was he who made me adjutant, which was, you know, was a sort of a promotion for me. And I was made a temporary captain. I was only 22. And really, I was a bit like a fish out of water, because I had no suitable training at all or experience. You know, I'd never been an adjutant in a barracks or a camp situation. And there I was, and I just had to do it by the seat of the pants, as it were, you know, just find out. But I'm sure it was Larry Stringer. I really didn't confirm that with him if he was.
And what were your duties as adjutant? If you could just tell us.
The battalion was deployed around there. And what it was mainly doing then was just sort of showing the flag. We were still in the non-fraternizing stage. We were not supposed to fraternize with the civilian government. So we were just going about the place and maintaining guard posts and that sort of thing. And then we were engaging in games and sports. We had an athletics meeting, and we had rugby matches and hockey matches. All those things had to be organized. The main thing was to keep everybody occupied as much as possible. I forget at what stage the sort of non-fraternization was lifted. And I forget at what stage Colonel Dennis Worrell came back. But I do remember him sitting in the battalion in his office one morning. We had a very nice little mess We just commandeered the buildings we wanted. I just went to that little tenement quarters we had there. We had a similar nice house just up the road. And I was billeted across the road in the Burgermeister's house, where there was a nice grand piano, which I which I invited myself to play. I had the best room in the house, and so on. You know, that was the sort of feeling. And, I don't know that we... the winter had not set in, as far as I remember, by the time that we were ordered to go up to Vienna.
Now, that's where you were going to be the garrison ceremonial troops.
That's right.
What do you recall of that?
Well, quite a lot. Vienna was under four-power control. It wasn't only three-power control. You know, it was four-power control. We were the first British battalion to represent the UK when it became the UK's battalion, to take charge of the city. We did it on a monthly rotation. And we went up there. I forget exactly when it would be. It would be something like November.
October to November.
And we took over from the French, took over the guard duty. The idea was that we had to maintain the presence in the city and man certain checkpoints. And that's, well, I don't know if we were checking anything, but it was flag showing and generally occupying the city. And presumably we had a town mayor and managed the civil government. We had a parade when we took over from the French. That's our colonel in that photograph taking over from the French colonel. And as I recall, at the end of the period, we had a similar parade where we handed over, and I can't remember whether it was the Americans or the Russians.
How did you get on with the Russians who were...
I didn't happen personally have very much dealing with them.
You were still acting as adjutant.
I was adjutant, yes. I was not only acting, but I was very busy. And we were in Schönbrunn Barracks. Schönbrunn Palace, actually, we were in Schönbrunn Barracks. And I remember being visited there by General Fritz McCreary, who presumably was the corps commander at that time, or possibly the other one, I don't know. But do you know what the main occupation there was? It was a very severe winter in Moscow. And of course, there was no the power stations and all those things had failed, had been run down, so there wasn't any fuel or something. And the battalion's main occupation, in fact, total occupation, apart from manning these presence posts, was cutting timber. And had to organize that, you know, various parties to go out into the forest, into the Vienna woods, and all the troops were engaged, long working day, felling trees and sawing timber and stacking it in round meters, which is a meter long. You know. That was the fuel of the city, as I remember, in the winter of 45. But life went on, surprisingly.
Were you aware of the black market in Vienna? It's supposed to have been fairly...
I don't remember now being aware of that. I was aware of being very busy in my office, organising those working parties and the guards. At that time, also, leave to the UK was being started, home leave. And that was a complicated system worked out according to how old people were, or how long they'd been serving abroad, and how long they'd been in the army. And you were given a group number and that sort of thing as to entitlement for leave. I don't think we'd started releasing people, getting people for release from the service at that time. Principally, we had a group number for them, depending on your age and length of service, and that sort of thing. So I was very busy. I don't remember much about the black market. I don't remember anything. I don't remember socializing very much in Vienna, quite honestly. I was feeling my way, as the chief staff officer of the department.
How did you get on with Worrell, or the colonel?
Well enough, I suppose. But... As I started to say earlier, when we were in Vilna, I remember at the very beginning, and him sitting in frustration in his office at about 8:30 in the morning and saying, and I was coming, you know, and he's saying, oh, you've sent me, Russell, where is the bump? You know, why I'm here I am and there's nothing in my in tray. What am I meant to do? And of course, I didn't know what he was meant to do. It was always as strange to me. And I mean, the post hadn't come in at that time. He was a regular soldier. He should have known more about it than I should. So, I mean, I really got no training or instruction much what to do. But, well, we got on all right. I mean, he didn't sack me. And, you know, and then in fact, it wasn't long, but as it happened, I was coming up to be in line for leave to the UK.
Did you go back to Wildon after?
Wildon, yes. Yes, we did. We finished the tour. Did we?
Yeah, back to Wildon on 28th of November.
Ah, well, then it was touch and go. I'm trying to recall then when I set out for my home team from Vienna, when we went back to Wildon, they called it there, by the way, all their W's and V's. And so I came to call it there. I think we had to much have gone back there. We did go back there. And we had one or two hair-raising parties with our gunner friends. And when we have reunions now, we still recall those times.
In what way hair-raising?
Oh, you know, plenty of drinks and hijinks, you know, games in the mess, high cockalorum, and then we had a sort of regimental song that we sang and things like that. You know what fellows do when they get in high spirits and had a bit to drink. One of the chaps, he died a girl, an only girl, was a very nice man. He married a girl from Vienna, and she still comes to the. Well, I'm hoping she'll come this year. Not from Vienna. From Graz. If I didn't say that again, I'd say from Graz, the gunner from Graz. So we had some party there. And anyway, from there, I went on, my number came up, and I was able to go on leave.
How long did you get?
I can't remember exactly, but it was something like 28 days altogether, I think. I don't think I may have had 28 days in the UK. But the journey was a torturous journey. I had to go by road. Cross country, I think we went by road to Marseille, and then by train across country. By sea to Marseille. And they went by road down to Athens, and then by sea to Marseille. And then I may be wrong about this because I may be confusing when I came home finally. But then across France by train. On another occasion, there was a year later, I came home permanently, as it were, having done my job.
Did you enjoy your leave?
Oh, very much, yes, very much. It was Christmas, 1945. I was very lucky. I was here at Christmas 1945, which was very, very fortunate, really. And I went to see Mary, of course, as soon as I landed in London. And we kept. So I had 28 days leave, but just to finish that bit, and when I went back to Austria afterwards, Archie Vizard, Major Vizard, had taken over from me. He's a bit older than me, and had sort of administrative experience in cities, and is a very good operator anyway, very efficient, and he then managed the rundown of the disbandment.
Because you were disbanded in February.
16th year, I was only a wartime attack, was only formed, I believe, in about 1940. And so, and the rule was like the trade union, the last in, first out sort of thing. So the battalion was disbanded, and I received a posting order, which I still had 12 months to serve overseas, to go and join the 2nd Battalion of my own regiment. I was commissioned in the Duke of Cornwall Infantry, and I was sent to them as adjutant.
How did you feel about that? Because did you feel the Durhams were now your regiment?
No, not really. I had mixed feelings, I suppose. But I mean, it was logical that I should be sent to the Second Battalion due to forms landing rather than to a regular battalion nearby, which, you know, I could have been, but that would have been quite illogical. They were in the same brigade. So I was sent to back to Greece, where those two DCLI were, two DCLI, two DCLI. And I was appointed to be adjutant. I was sent to be adjutant, as it were. I was agreed to go then. And to that, you know, carry on, they came to come to me, and they told me that was everything. So I had to get in one of those round bottom boats again and to go back to Greece. This is in January 46 or something like that. And I remember at the time the first Greek elections were to take place, post-war elections. And there was an Allied mission for the observation of the Greek elections, known as Anaphoge. And a whole lot of odds and sods of officers from all over the place were made to go to Greece and be observers of the election. And as it happened, a great number of them made that on the boat at the same time as I did. So I went back to Greece and became adjutant of a regular battalion. But having been an adjutant a little while before, I had some idea then. But even so, I didn't really know. You know, I was doing it all by ear, as it were. I went along. I mean, I hadn't been brought up. I hadn't had any training. I hadn't been subsequent myself in peacetime. And I just had to do it by common sense, really.
Now, you were you decided to make the army your career. I mean, you'd stayed in the army for the rest of your, you know, army career. What made, did you think of leaving the army? How did you take to peacetime soldiering?
Well, the natural expectation was that I would have left the army and come home, I didn't really have anything in particular to come home for, if you like. And I mean, I had been in, all that I'd had to look forward to was going back to some college and studying to be a school teacher, which is, you know, all people seem to know about in the time of my in school here. That didn't particularly appeal to me. And since I was the adjutant and was able to see all the papers that came in from the battalion, you know, I saw information about applications for regular commissions and applications for also to go to the Royal Military College of Science, or the Military College of Science, as it was then, to continue one degree studies. And my CIO, Kerry Harding, he recommended me and advised me to apply for the regular commission. And so I did. And I had another long journey and go down by the road. We were up in northern Greece, up in a place called Drama, oddly enough. They say it's where the word Drama came from. And up getting on towards the Turkish border, I don't remember that yet. I had to go down by road to Athens, I suppose, and then across. What did I fly to Cairo? I had to go to Cairo, to a regular commission board. Anyway, and then I got my regular commission. I was told I'd got it. It wasn't actually published until January 47. So, and then by the end of 46, I had completed my tour of duty overseas. And, you know, my number came up, as they say, my release group came up. That was an exceptionally busy year, that was, because all the troops were either being, you know, demobilized, or some were going on leave still. And it was very, very difficult, you know, when people were kicking up your traces, selling their blankets on the black market and getting no good in a local town.
How did you find peacetime soldiering in comparison to wartime?
Well, that was not really peacetime then. That was a sort of twilight time, if you like. But then later on, of course, when I was in the regular army, you know, some years later, I found it more difficult in a way than wartime soldiering, because I didn't have the background. I missed being a subaltern and a young officer, and I wasn't brought up as a regular officer, you see. So I was really out of my depth, and I was always young for the job I was doing. I mean, I was a lieutenant colonel wearing badges of rank at the age of 32, and through now, and I really wasn't ready for it. So, and it really set me back a bit, and I was never really as much at ease as a senior officer, except when I got onto staff duties in the Ministry of Defence as a lieutenant colonel, where I was totally competent, and I guess I couldn't be again.